The U.S. war in Iran is expanding, but what kind of war is it? You're listening to SDPB's In the Moment. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. The United Nations Refugee Agency says as many as 3.2 million Iranians have been forced out of their homes by the war. Another front has opened in southern Lebanon, and the bombing and fighting continue. Frontline's documentary, Remaking the Middle East, the U.S., Israel, and Iran, is available now on the PBS app and online at pbs.org. I connected with producer and writer Anya Borg. We'll begin here with the impacts of the 2013 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that's otherwise known as President Obama's Iran nuclear deal.
One of the most dramatic pieces of the JCPOA, as it was known, was that Israel at the time was very opposed to the deal. And Netanyahu was prime minister at the time. They were concerned that the provisions would expire, I believe, in 2025 and 2030. They were concerned that Iran would not be in compliance with the deal. So Israel was quite opposed. The Obama administration actually began negotiations for the deal in secret. It took about 2 years to come to a deal, and then it was rather historic when they did. The evidence shows that Iran did stay in compliance with that deal, although there is some debate about that.
So when Donald Trump comes into the White House for the first time, he declares he's going to dismantle what he calls the, quote, disastrous deal with Iran. And moving forward, then, that's another big sea change. How did that challenge the prevailing logic of the Middle East?
Well, Donald Trump had campaigned against the nuclear deal. So I think it was not completely unexpected that he would withdraw from it. He actually spent about a year trying to renegotiate the deal, trying to impose what they called maximum pressure sanctions, and they ultimately found that to be unworkable. After withdrawing from the deal in 2018, it really destroyed any trust between the U.S. and Iran. And from the perspective of the Iranians, it kind of confirmed the suspicions they'd had that the U.S. had never really been serious about a peace effort. So it kind of confirmed the worst suspicions of hardliners in Iran, and it actually elevated them within the Iranian regime. The hardliners used it as an opportunity to say, we were right about the way in which we had, you know, we had also been suspicious of this deal. It really frayed anything moving forward. And in many ways, it's a very important moment to where we are today. Yeah. I mean, if you think about the current war, it can't be separated from that decision that Donald Trump made in 2018.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you make a strong historical case for how Prime Minister Netanyahu's cabinet is changing and some hardliners there that are coming to power and the pressures that he's facing, corruption allegations against him. I was taken with how many times throughout the documentary I was noticing how skilled Netanyahu was and is at communicating with Donald Trump, which is sometimes a very specific thing to do. Help me understand how you saw in the way that he changed the way he was talking to the United States, even to adjust for the personality of this president.
Well, I'm not privy to their internal conversations,
sure.
But I think that what it appears from the outside is that Benjamin Netanyahu kind of gets Trump. And understands the political context in which, I mean, Netanyahu is in many ways American. I think he understands American politics very well. He went to high school in Philadelphia. He spent a good portion of his life as a ambassador in the U.S. So he understands American politics in a fairly unique way. And I think he understands Trump and what makes him tick and how to speak to him and his administration very well. And, you know, in this, many American presidents have held Netanyahu at arm's length. I think Joe Biden was struggling with how to relate to the Netanyahu administration, particularly as the war in Gaza progressed. and as Netanyahu's coalition in Israel has become increasingly radical, but that kind of distance does not exist between the Trump administration and the Netanyahu administration. They appear to be working extremely closely and to share many of the same goals in the region.
Netanyahu wants to take the plight of the Palestinians, what's happening in Gaza, off the world's agenda. And in some ways, at the Abraham Accords and other places, he's been successful at doing that. What are some of the ways that we saw Netanyahu having conversations and shaking hands in the region, but ensuring that nothing in Gaza would change, essentially?
Benjamin Netanyahu's entire political career in many ways has been trying to sideline the Palestinian issue. He rose to power in 1996 as prime minister on a platform opposing the Oslo Peace Accords. He has consistently been opposed to the idea of the creation of a Palestinian state. So I think it was sort of no surprise to see that he was promoting the Abraham Accords during the first Trump administration, which was an idea that Israel could create peace with many of the Arab states without a Palestinian state, which had always been a requisite for many of the Arab nations to consider recognizing Israel and having a peace accord. So that was an incredible success from Netanyahu's point of view, that he could finally make peace without having to, you know, give up the one thing he's never been willing to give up.
Meanwhile, October 7th, 2023, deadliest attack in Israeli history, 6,000 militants, something like that, actually breached the border. The Israeli defenses are overwhelmed. More than 1,200 Israelis are killed, most of them civilians, most of them in brutal fashion. There are more than 250 hostages, including children. This changes the psychology of the government in what ways that we're still seeing play out today?
I think this was one of the most interesting things just as a filmmaker to encounter in making this film, is that in interviews that we have done with members of the defense establishment, the intelligence world in Israel, that everything for them is a kind of before October 7th and after October 7th. This idea that Israel is now operating with what they call the new security doctrine, that prior to October 7th, Israel had kind of allowed threats to grow on its borders, whether, you know, Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, that this idea that they were willing to tolerate certain low-level threats is over. And from the perspective of the Israeli defense establishment, they really say, like, they will not do that. And we heard this most pronounced, I think, in our film from a gentleman named General Amador, who was a national security advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu over a decade ago, but he still is kind of a prominent voice in that world. And he really said, like, Israel is operating with this new security doctrine, and moving forward, we will not tolerate these kinds of threats to grow on our border. And I think in many ways that presages where we are today, because this current war is a response to Iran continuing to build its ballistic missile program, which Israel has felt threatened by. And in the past, Israel has tolerated Iran having ballistic missiles. But after October 7th and after the war last summer, in which Israel saw the devastation those missiles could have inside Israel, they're unwilling to allow that to continue.
So President Trump said in 2025 that we had totally obliterated Iran's nuclear sites. What are we after now?
I think that that remains very unclear, and is part of the problem that the administration is having, and that they haven't really articulated the case for war to the American public. They've offered a number of differing rationales. They've said that Iran was trying to take over the Middle East. They've said that Iran was rebuilding its nuclear program. They've said that Israel was going to attack, and within 24 hours, the U.S. would be drawn into a war. They've offered a number of sort of slightly differing rationales for what the threat was. And it raises this larger question of whether that was, you know, an imminent threat, or, as we were just discussing around the security doctrine, that Israel has a low-level threat. Unlike in the Iraq war, where the administration spent a great deal of trying to build a case with the public. The Trump administration hasn't done that. I think there's a lot of confusion right now about why we are in this war, actually.
And are there questions about whether it's legal? What are the, you know, parameters internationally for when you can go into another country and drop bombs?
Yeah,
that was a really compelling.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding from our interviews is, and I think that this is a debated area of international law, but there is a distinction between what is called preemptive and preventive wars. So preemptive wars are where there's an imminent threat that, you know, in that case, a war, I believe under international law is considered justified. This is being described to us in our interviews as a preventive war, which is that, you know, Israel saw threats that they did not want to allow to grow. And we put that question to a former national security advisor for Netanyahu, General Amador, and he didn't challenge it. I mean, he sort of said, yes, this is a preventive war. And if that's illegal under international law, so be it, because we simply can't tolerate that anymore. We've learned the hard way from October 7th that we will not tolerate that. And we're seeing that. I think that this, it raises a larger question internationally around the war in Ukraine, that are we seeing more quote-unquote preventive wars, cases in which a strong country sees an opportunity to attack a weaker country? It's a troubling trend if that's the case.
Yeah, a war of choice then. And that brings up the question of what is victory? So we hear, you know, what is the end game? We've heard things like total victory, unconditional surrender from Iran. I'm not hearing from the administration a call for peace, thoughts on healing wounds, any kind of end game. Again and again, you're asking people about the death of civilians and non-combatants, and they are answering you in this documentary with things like, yes, it's unfortunate, but that's war. War is awful. We'd rather not kill civilians, but it's going to happen. Where does this all end, or where does it even go next? What are you seeing?
I don't know. It's terribly concerning. I mean, we asked someone from the Israeli Defense Establishment that question, where does this end? And his response was, it ends when Israel and the U.S. have decided that Iran is too weak to attack. But I think, you know, the events in just the last 24 hours in which the new supreme leader in Iran is clearly not backing down and vowing to avenge these attacks and close the Strait of Hormuz are concerning. They are not willing to capitulate in any way. And I think it raises the question of whether the U.S. had really anticipated what they were getting into. We don't know enough at this point about what the Trump administration had gamed out. But it does seem that they have been surprised that this is not going in the same way that, for instance, the events in Venezuela went. I think that, you know, President Trump in January with the capture of Nicolas Maduro had felt like perhaps it will be easy to come in and decapitate a regime and get the political establishment to sort of bend to his will. And I think in Iran is an entirely different country and context and history. And what we're seeing is that it is not going to play out that way. Yeah. It's quite concerning that what is now a regional war could continue to escalate, could continue to simmer, could continue to spread, even to the U.S.
Anya Borg is a writer and producer for Frontline's documentary Remaking the Middle East. It's available to watch now on the PBS app or online at pbs.org. That's our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.